Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It gives me enormous pleasure to welcome you all to LSE for this evening's lecture. My name's Heather Jones, and I'm Associate Professor in International History here at the LSE. And I'm very pleased to be here welcoming Dr. Robert Johnson to the stage today. Dr. Rob Johnson is the Director of the Changing Character of War program at Oxford University, a very prestigious program that unites theory and practice with regard to the history of warfare. He's also Senior Research Fellow of Pembroke College and Associate of the Department of Politics and International Relations at Oxford University. And Dr. Johnson's primary research interests are in strategy, its development, and the history of war which informs it. His regional interest is in Afghanistan, South Asia, and the Middle East, but also a number of security issues as well, particularly terrorism, insurgency, and counterinsurgency, all of which I think form part of this new book and elements of what you're discussing there, and particularly strategic history of the First World War in the Middle East, which is a personal interest of mine as well. So I'm really looking forward to the Q&A this evening with the audience. And he's also interested in how conflicts can be terminated through transition and negotiation, and civil-military relations in the making of strategy. Again, another key theme in the book, which looks a lot at grassroots agency in the Middle East throughout the war, revising some of our opinions about the extent to which local decision-makers played a role in the conflict. He's also interested in the role of auxiliary forces and in the dynamics of insurrection, and is currently concluding a monograph on the strategic advantages and risks of partnering regular indigenous forces, and has recently delivered papers on cohesion in combat, joint operations, future operating environment, and strategy making in the 21st century. So really fusing history, international relations, politics, and contemporary events, I think, in many ways. He convenes the UK Strategy Forum and is assisting the British Armed Forces in planning for reconfigured structures and missions, and is focused on the difficulties of planning future war using historical examples. However, this evening he's here really with something of a historian's hat on, I think, to discuss the Great War in the Middle East. A really fascinating topic, one which he points out has been under-researched by historians until recently. I think that's a very valid point, particularly about First World War historians who've tended to shy away from the topic. It's a huge topic. It requires a lot of different languages. It's quite a complex topic. So there has been, I think, for historians, really also something of a Western hierarchy in how they see the war. And that's something that we'll hopefully be hearing about in Dr. Johnson's lecture. And this is really the event to launch the book. So copies are on sale in the corner. This is its London launch. So this is really a new book. It's not yet available, actually, in our local Waterstones on LSE campus. That's how new it is. So please right. Get yourself a copy here this evening if you're interested in it and if you're interested in the topic. And then a couple of housekeeping announcements before we begin. Our exits are located to the left and to the right. In the event of a fire alarm sounding, please proceed in an orderly way to the exits and outside from the main reception. For those who are tweeting in the audience, the hashtag for this evening's talk is #LSEWW1. Okay, so LSE World War One, LSEWW1. And as usual, after the lecture, there'll be a chance for questions with our speaker. But for now, will you please join me in welcoming Dr. Johnson? Thank you.
I'd like to say, first of all, a very warm thank you to have such a nice introduction, and also to friends and relations who have been very kind to turn up. Most of all, to you, thank you very much for coming. This is an incredibly important subject, which is presumably why you're here. You didn't come here to see me, you came here to hear about the subject. And I thought, out of courtesy to you, I'm not going to speak for the full length of time that LSE has very generously given me, because I think there are so many people here who are interested in the subject. We should have longer, if that's okay, for you to make comments and ask questions and pose particular points of view. But the whole point is to open up the discussion. I think that's what academics should be doing, not pontificating about what they know. Let me begin with a quotation, a comment. This is David Lloyd George, the British Prime Minister, in 1917, addressing the concerns of his own parliament, and indeed making a comment about his own army, which was determined to focus all of its energy and effort, in a rather Clausewitzian way, on the Western Front during the First World War. I don't have a Welsh accent, so I'll have to do it without the Welsh. But he said, "The British Empire owes a great deal to sideshows. During the Seven Years' War, which was also a great European war, the events which are best remembered by every Englishman are not the great battles on the continent of Europe, but Plassey and the Heights of Abraham. And I have no doubt that when the history of 1917 comes to be written and comes to be read ages hence, these events in Mesopotamia and Palestine will hold a much more conspicuous place in the minds and memories of the people than many events which looms much larger for the moment in our sight, he could have said, in France. So Lloyd George's contention was, when the First World War history comes to be written, we won't be writing about France and Flanders and the trenches, or war poets or anything like that, we'll be all writing about the Middle East. Well, the reason why I started this book project is because one of the things I found is the sheer discrepancy of volumes on the First World War in the Middle East. What is this book about? What am I trying to do? Well, the subtitle is A Strategic Study. It is about the making of strategy or the study of strategy. Now, you might think, why bother with that? Isn't the point of what we've learnt about histories of the First World War over the last 20 years or so been this fascination with the experience of war? You know, the last veterans are now gone. So if we're going to understand the First World War, the argument usually is we have to do that from the point of view of the archives, the records we have, of the individual's experience of that war. But of course there is an intellectual flaw with such an obsession. And that is that if you only study the experiences of soldiers in the trenches, you come to the very quick conclusion there is no purpose to this particular conflict, it's a futile waste of life, and what on earth with these ancestors of ours doing. If we were to go and study the decision makers and try to understand the difficulties they faced, the calculations they made, the risks they took, we might get closer to understanding really what the First World War was about. And those of you who are studying international relations, this is fundamentally what matters to you, is how people make decisions. Now, this book is not just about the British. I happen to be British by accident of birth, but I'm very interested in the interactions that took place. The British decision makers and the French decision makers, the Ottoman decision makers, the German decision makers, and critically, of course, the people of the region itself. And, of course, it's easy to use the shorthand, the Arab peoples, but, of course, immediately my friends at Oxford say, well, which Arabs do you mean? Because we have to acknowledge that all the other ethnic groups, minorities, and nationalities that live within the wider Middle East. When I came to do the research, what I found straight away was that everything is connected. We think we live in a connected world today. Well, that's a long-established idea. And the Middle East has been a connecting region for generations and generations, for hundreds if not thousands of years. So it would be probably no surprise then to learn that the events that are occurring in the First World War for the Middle East involved British military forces being sent to the Sudan. It also involved Russian forces fighting the Caucasus. It involved Indian conspiratorial nationalist groups trying to foment unrest inside the subcontinent. And at the same time involved German forces making calculations in 1918 about where to commit resources and whether to go to the Balkans or whether to reinforce the Middle East. In other words, the Middle East is the sort of epicentre of this war. And when you take that view and you look at British strategic decision-making, the centre of gravity of this war for the British in 1914-1918 is not France or Flanders. It is, I'm sure you'll know, the Suez Canal. That is the imperial axis. That is the meridian by which decisions are being made about the First World War. And actually, those of you who study the Second World War will know that actually very similar calculations are made, which is why the British Army in the Second World War ends up fighting in North Africa with more resources than they actually commit to the defence of southern England in 1941. So this is about interactions. Interactions between the empires, the Ottomans, the French, the Russians, Germany, as well as Britain. It's, I think, important to consider the issues that are going on before the war, during the conflict, and immediately afterwards. Many of these studies of the First World War tend to be sort of quite separated. You find studies are about the cause of the war, entire volumes devoted to what led to the war in 1914. And then once you get to September 1914, you sort of lose interest and that's the end of it. And therefore, when those studies, those works, look at decision-making or the making of strategy, they're of course only really concerned with that sort of early period. Then the war itself, the tendency is, if, you know, by separating the First World War only as 1914, 1918, or indeed, you should say, till January 1919, because there's no actual peace until 1919. The problem there is, again, if you're trying to look at decision-making and the making of strategy, you're going to miss the pre-war assumptions and conditions, and more importantly, what the war aims, or you might say peace aims, are, that emerge between 1916 through to the mid-1920s. Okay? And as far as the, I don't need to tell you, I'm sure you know, the First World War in the Middle East, yes, you could argue begins in October of 1914, but it doesn't really technically end until 1923 with the Treaty of Lausanne. And also, I think it's worth pointing out that the peacemaking process lasts longer than the conflict itself. Okay, a 5-year process of peacemaking, a 4-year process of war. A lot of the works, a lot of the scholarship of the First World War, even that deals with the Middle East, is separated. So we have a large number of works. Guess which campaign? Those of you who are military historians will know precisely which campaign gets all the attention in the First World War in the Middle East. It's Gallipoli. Well done. Absolutely right. Go to the top of the class. Thank you very much indeed for being volunteering. Absolutely right. Vast numbers of works on Gallipoli. You might find the odd handful on Mesopotamia, largely because of our recent interest in the war in Iraq. Very few, indeed, on Palestine, and frankly, almost none on Turkish Ottoman operations in the Caucasus. Where was the bulk of the Ottoman army deployed in the First World War? Yes, you guessed it, in the Caucasus, not at Gallipoli. Indeed, one of the interesting things about the Gallipoli campaign, the reason why it's strategically significant, one of many reasons, is because it diverted vast numbers of Ottoman soldiers from the Caucasus, which led to their biggest military disaster, Erzurum, in 1916. And again, these interconnected features of the First World War are often overlooked or missed because of this interest in campaign histories. So I wanted to put all this back together and look at how strategy gets reshaped and remade as the dynamics of war unfold. Again, those of you who are interested in international relations need to be mindful that international relations is not simply constructed in international institutions or in governments. It is shaped, directed, diverted and deflected by war itself. And if we need an example, we only need to look at recent events in Syria to find a good example of exactly what that looks like. So I would argue that international relations, there's a lot we can derive from this pre-duration and post-war First World War situation in the Middle East. It's a great case to study, and I think there's an awful lot of interesting paradoxes to look at. Let me deal with a couple of the interesting things I think that would feature for you with your interest in this area. The first paradox of the First World War for the British in the Middle East is the British didn't want to fight there. Categorically, their obsession was to keep open the Suez Canal, their most important commercial artery and a reinforcement route from India primarily, but also the rest of the Australia, New Zealand and so on, the rest of the empire, through to Europe, and they don't want a war. Russia, too, began the war with feeling that the Caucasus was to be kept absolutely quiet. No offensive operations were authorised. Garrison was minimised. In fact, Russian soldiers, when they arrived, thought they had a really lucky number. This meant, you know, getting lots of logs together, building a few cabins, and sitting out the war in the mountains because no one is going to fight here, they thought. What's very interesting when you look at the literature is that the Ottoman Empire is regarded often as the sort of victim. These are the people that lose. The Ottoman Empire is broken up by the victorious allies, and these conspiratorial, nefarious allies, the ones who carve up the Middle East and divide the Arab peoples, we're told, for their own imperial gain. Well, let's just go back a step. The Ottoman Empire was the aggressor. They initiate military operations against the Russians, initially, in October. They're the aggressor in the sense that they were the ones that possessed a revisionist war plan. Their objective was to recover territory lost during the Balkan Wars, two of which they had lost in quick succession. They were led by a militaristic junta, for want of a better term, a triumvirate of three, who believed that the entire resources of the Ottoman Empire should be mobilised on total war footing as soon as the Ottoman Empire was ready. In fact, they go too early. They're not ready when the war breaks out, with disastrous consequences. Another paradox or misunderstanding, I think, about the First World War is about this issue, and I'm going to go straight for the jugular on this one, is about this general view which has prevailed since the First World War that the British, primarily, and the French deliberately carved up the Arab peoples to keep them weak and divided so they could govern the area. Absolutely not. The documentary evidence, the archives, the correspondence between the key actors and decision makers does not support such a thesis in any way whatsoever. Now, I know you're going to cite to me, I've put the map up for you. Ah, yes, Dr. Johnson, but what about the Sykes-Picot Agreement, you'll say? Well, let me deal with that, if I may, in a slightly longer-term way, a slightly long-winded way, but let me get to this. Let's look, first of all, at the situation in Arabia and the southern part of the Ottoman Empire in 1914. Is this a united region? No. The rivalries and the bitterness between various different groups in southern Arabia and central Arabia was acute. Even when the war breaks out, the Arab peoples are not united in their support for the Ottoman Empire and the Caliph, or indeed any concept of caliphate. The biggest rivalries are exercised by Ibn Saud, who had seized Riyadh, and the Hashemite dynasty of Mecca and Medina. But there are other rivalries, the Idrisis, for example. Now the Yemenis were involved. The British were pro the Sultan of Muscat, which is today's United Emirates. They had a long-standing protectionist agreement with the Trucial States, today's United Arab Emirates. The Emir of Kuwait was an ally of the British in 1899 in defiance of the Ottoman Empire, and the Kuwaitis remain sided with the British throughout the entire war. Ibn Rashid is the great enemy of the British and pro the Ottoman Empire, but he's on the losing side. These are just a few. If you then go down to the sort of smaller and smaller subdivisions and look at the Hawtat, the Angeli, and other groups within the Hejaz, for example, bitter, bitter divisions. And the Romantics, the Arabists, who form the bulk of the members of the Arab Bureau, people like T.E. Lawrence and others, Gilbert Clayton. I mean, these are the people who leave Arabia at the end of the First World War and during the peacemaking afterwards, disillusioned men and women. I say women because, of course, you all know about Gertrude Bell. I'm sure we can't leave her out of the story. I think one of the things we need to do as scholars is reject a teleology. You know, teleological approach that you have a situation in history, you look back in the past to find the point of origin of that particular situation, you then reverse and come back towards the future, you'll be left with only one deduction, that this was either inevitable or there was a path, a crooked though it may be, towards this particular historical outcome. That is not the way that we should approach this problem. Just because there was a division of Arabia, some of which fell under British and French jurisdiction, does not mean that was the planning assumption of 1914 or indeed 1915. Now, if I was to do a quick straw poll, how many of you have already heard of the Sykes-Picot Agreement? Just a quick handshake. Almost everyone. How many of you know, be honest now, be honest, how many of you are familiar with the DeBunson Committee Report? Interesting straw poll. That's usually what happens when I ask people about this. The DeBunson Committee Report, I commend it to you, it's in the National Archives. It's about 30, 40 pages long. You can buy it for about £7 if you don't want to go to Kew itself. It lays out the British war plan of 1915. What Georges-François Picot and Mark Sykes were doing was irrelevant, and you make this absolutely clear, irrelevant to the British government. Indeed, the Sykes-Picot agreement about a rough indication of spheres of influence was repudiated by the government, and in 1918 was discredited entirely. In fact, British government ministers are saying in 1918, the Sykes-Picot agreement is dead and buried and good riddance to it. So, not quite what we were led to believe with these things about a conspiracy. The de Bunsen Committee was established by Asquith, the British Prime Minister, in 1915. It came up with essentially four sort of options when they went through all the kind of different permutations of what it was. Number one, option one, partition the Ottoman Empire, leaving only Anatolia in the hands of the Turks. Option two, preserve the Ottoman Empire, which had been the long-standing British tradition of foreign policy dating right back to the early 19th century, but allocate spheres of influence or areas of control, like Persia, so independent government, but some sort of protectionist jurisdiction over certain parts of the region, particularly Arab allies of the United Kingdom. Number three, option three, preserve the Ottoman Empire as it is, but without its Balkans possessions. Strip the Ottoman Empire of Thrace and make sure they don't ever recover any parts of Bulgaria or Greece, depending how the war goes. Option four, create a federated state with autonomous regions, or independent regions, for a better term, for the Arabs, the Kurds, Armenians, and so on. And guess what option they went for? Option four, create a federated Ottoman state with independent or autonomous regions for each of these ethnic groups. Now, we're not often told that, are we? Right? But there it all is in the archives. This is the British plan. This is the British government's position in its so-called desiderata, or war aims, if you like. Their strategic imperative of coming up with this particular option is very interesting. They wanted to curb German influence in the region. The pre-war concern had been about Germans overrunning this area and creating for themselves their own new sort of form of empire. Many of you have heard of this. Wilhelm II of Germany even liked to spread the rumour that he had secretly converted to Islam. Now, I don't know how many people in the Middle East either knew that or already believed it, but it is an interesting idea. It's a bit like kind of Vladimir Putin pretending to be the friends of all Arabs, but there we are. Another aim of the British was to block Russian expansion south of the Caucasus Mountains. Again, a long-standing pre-war consideration. And then the French were to be blocked from interfering in the future of the Middle East, particularly from interfering with Arab states. The French colonial lobby, a committee Azi, were actually the ones who really said, well, we'll accept the British approach. What they wanted was control of the Mediterranean. They already felt they had controlled most of West and North Africa. They felt very bitter that they had not secured Egypt in 1881 or the Sudan in 1898. And so if they could create a greater Syria, which included present-day Palestine and Israel, if they could create a greater Syria, they felt they could rival the British and create influence in the eastern Mediterranean as well as in the west and the centre of that sea. Were Arab polities and clans betrayed? No. Bitter divisions were played out during the war, I would argue, on this particular occasion. Right, so I'm getting overrunning time already. Well, I started these, so I'm going to be very brief about some of these things. I'd love to tell you more about the sort of narrative of the war, in a sense, so those of you who are not familiar with it, but I'm going to leave that really essentially to hopefully you kind of feeling you might buy a copy of the book if you're so generous. I'm sorry I missed Christmas, those of you who saw on Diwali, sorry about that. Maybe it'll come up. For one area we must mention in terms of strategic decision makers, though, because it's so potent and it's so current, is this question of the security of secular polities, or indeed in this case empires, threatened by some kind of notion of jihad, or Gaza, we should say, an offensive war. And there were clearly great unease amongst British decision makers about this so-called jihadist potential threat, because the caliph of the Ottoman Empire could at any point issue a fatwa, as he did in November 1914, against Britain and France, saying the subjects of the British and French empires must rise up in rebellion. Britain and France therefore felt it was necessary for them to defend themselves, and that they had to deal with this aggressive threat that they faced. They also had to defend themselves, of course, against the very first offensives of this conflict, launched by the Ottoman Empire. They go in two directions. They strike against Suez, which is the disaster. They also try to strike against Russia at the same time. They split their resources, largely because of ridiculous ambitions they have. And that, too, is a disaster, particularly the Battle of Sarakamish. If you've never heard of it, it's one of the greatest battles of the First World War, and yet very, very few people outside the region, indeed, have ever heard of it. Absolutely critical. It's very interesting to look at the assessments that were made in the very first year of the war, for the first few months of the war, by the British about how they thought the war was going. And there was clearly a stalemate in Europe, and famously there is a debate in the British war cabinets about, do we look for alternatives? Do we knock away the props of Germany by hammering on the doors of the Ottoman Empire and force them to come to peace? Why choose that route? Well, because the early experience of the British and the French against the Ottoman Empire, it had all gone their way. And you'll hopefully find in the book, you know, amusing incidents. Alexandretta, for example, an attempt to cut off the Ottoman Turks from their Arabian possessions. The governor of Alexandretta was so accommodating to the Royal Navy that turned up to bombard the railway line that he actually offers to blow up the trains himself so the British wouldn't be put to any bother in doing so. This was not, Winston Churchill said, we're not dealing with a thoroughly efficient military power. That was the assumption in late 1914. There were different views, though, within the official mind. Again, for those of you studying international relations, it's very important to remember, you know, when we talk about countries, we say Britain, we say America, we say Germany, of course, we are talking about very different constituencies within these decision makers. Political leaders have very different views from the military in this conflict. The government of India had its own view. It felt its priority was to protect the Gulf, protect the landward routes to India. That's all that actually mattered. To compromise on all these differences, they came up with this famous Dardanelles plan, that they were going to push their way through to Constantinople and bombard, if necessary, the Ottoman capital. It was going to be a Royal Naval operation. They had untrained Australian and New Zealand soldiers and a few territorial reservists. They only had one remaining British army division. The idea was the Navy would clear the route and this inexperienced force would simply march ashore unopposed to occupy the territory and oversee the peace negotiations, which they felt would inevitably follow. They didn't get their way. And I think it's worth bearing in mind about the Gallipoli offensive. There's a historian that I know very well who said that it was a sheer lunacy, it could never have succeeded. Well, that's just unjust, actually, because it was under-resourced. If I just tell you this one simple fact, does anyone happen to know here, by the way, just how many British and Imperial soldiers were available to assault on the Dardanelles Strait, the Gallipoli Peninsula? It's about 73,000. The minimum calculation by their own intelligence service and by the Greeks who had done a war calculation the year before was 300,000 would be the minimum required. They send 73,000. The Turkish army, the Ottoman army rather, has got 97,000 available to oppose the landing. Not really surprising. It wasn't really going to go the Allies' way. The thing to talk about, though, is not just about Gallipoli. Everyone's well known about that, but the subversive component of the war is often not talked about. Both sides try to invoke an Islamic revolution. Both sides. The Germans have a very naive view of how it should go. The Ottomans use it as a sort of springboard for sectarianism, frankly, in a new sort of Turkish nationalist kind of way. And the British, ironically, end up being most successful, largely because of pre-war kind of correspondence with the Hashemite dynasty. But the cooperation only occurs once the war is going badly for the British. It's also worth working out, you know, how they make these sort of decisions. And it is worth pointing out that the so-called Arab revolt isn't an Arab revolt. There's about 15,000 Arab fighters of various different clans in the Arab Northern Army in 1917-1918. There are 300,000 Arab soldiers still fighting the Ottoman Army in the same year. So 15,000 on the Allied side, 300,000 on the Ottoman side. We have to be very careful about this. And the reason I mention that is because in Ottoman, in Turkish historiography today, you will find the reason why the war was lost for twofold. One is the leaders of the Ottoman Empire made the wrong plans, and the second reason is we were let down or betrayed by Arab fighters. Nothing could be further than the truth. Probably fully one third of all the fighters fighting for the Ottoman Empire at Gallipoli were indeed Arab personnel. Again, I haven't got time to go through, expand the whole book, but there is just one or two perhaps final highlights to think about. One is the fact that 1917 is a year of crisis. We forget in First World War studies how critical this year actually was. The Allies were losing the war in late 1917. New governments had come to power, it's true, Lloyd George in Britain, Clemenceau in France, and there was a new hope about the United States being involved in the war from February 1917. But the Americans wouldn't arrive in force until the summer of 1918. Everyone knew that. There weren't enough Americans. The Atlantic supply route was being so severely affected that Britain was down to 6 weeks of wheat supply in its own country. In Caporetto, the Italian army had been so badly routed it retreated for 250 miles. The Russian Revolution had broken out. It's quite clear the Russians were coming out of the war. The French had launched their so-called Nivelle Offensive in 1917 and were routed. In the Champagne and the Chemin des Dames, there was French soldiers going on strike, saying, "We will not fight. We will not advance again." Battle of Third Ypres for the British didn't work out terribly well. And in the air war, Britain was losing the air war against new German air machines. So what was the option? The Middle East, again, was reopened in 1917 as an antidote to the failures going on in Europe for the Allies. There are setbacks, Gaza, First Battle of Gaza. There are successes. The British capture, under General Frederick Stanley Maude, they capture Baghdad in March of 1917. And, of course, famously we hear about Lawrence capturing Aqaba in July. And then in November, after some differences of opinion between the British government and their own military, General Allenby, Edmund Allenby, captures Jerusalem. And really, it looks like it's all beginning to unravel for the Ottomans, but it doesn't. There are two attempts to take Amman by the British Army, British Egyptian Expeditionary Force and its imperial allies, which fail. And finally, at the Battle of Megiddo, there is a breakthrough success which breaks the remainder of the Ottoman army, which had been suffering desperately from disease and everything else. So I think probably that would be the war component we could deal with and say there are some important strategic decisions being made. There's also this issue, though, about how you make the peace. And although I'm not going to sort of go through all the sort of details of how it works out, but it is a complicated process. It's not a simple process. Different actors are involved. Even within governments, Lloyd George doesn't talk to his own cabinet colleagues about it or the Foreign Office. Georges Clemenceau admits the only reason he's not interested in Iraq or Greater Syria is because he's not interested in them. He's only interested in keeping his own right wing in French politics content, sufficient that he can return to power in France itself. They are bargaining chips in the worst possible sense. But if we were to come up with a strategic balance sheet about this conflict, just to conclude, are the ends fulfilled of the Entente or Allied powers? Yes. Britain achieves imperial security. Its commercial route through the Suez Canal is secure. Its Arab partners are secured. It has a buffer state against Russian ambitions, particularly communist ambitions in the 1920s. France, its ally, is satisfied to the extent it will have no further ambitions in the region. It gets Syria. Germany is contained. There is an Ottoman-Turkish resurgence, briefly, a Turkish national resurgence, but there's no interest amongst Turkish nationalists in reconquering Arabia. And the caliphate is officially abolished by the Turkish National Assembly in 1924. Britain acquires mandate territories. These are limited liabilities. The objective is they're all under the League of Nations. They're not British colonies. So in many ways, we have an outcome which satisfies all their war objectives, but of course leaves all sorts of legacies, which I'm hoping now, as we get to questions, and I know Heather's going to challenge me on a few of these things, and I haven't got time to unpack now all the different legacies or possibilities there may be. But, we know that they're important. All I would say as a plea is that these decisions are reached not because they have a grandiose plan or conspiracy for the Middle East. They are fighting a war. And at the end of that war, they have to come up with quite hasty, compromised solutions which satisfy most of their strategic objectives. They haven't got the foresight to see what's going to come up in 100 years from now. I'll pause there and let you take it away. Thank you very much.